For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Welcome along to the Christmas edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Twain Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on the show today, Noddy Holder, with the tale behind Merry Christmas, Everybody. Plus, TV presenter Timmy Mallett on his book Utterly Brilliant, My Life's Journey. Timmy Mallett is a British TV presenter, broadcaster and artist. It says on Wikipedia he's known for his striking visual style, colourful glasses, loud shirts and giant pink foam mallet, known as Mallett's Mallet, as well as his utterly brilliant catchphrases. You may remember him from Wackaday, the Wide Awake Club, or from his number one single, Itsy Witsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini. He's also the author and narrator of his book, Timmy Mallett, Utterly Brilliant, My Life's Journey.
It's a grey, damp, drizzly day with a cold wind in the middle of an emotionally unsettling March. And Mrs. Mallett wakes up, turns to me and says, "All right, Mally, this is it. How are you feeling?" Big long sigh, and I rub my tummy, something I seem to do to comfort myself, and I roll out of that lovely warm bed, thinking to myself, it's going to be the middle of May before I enjoy these sheets again. I don't have to do it. It's my choice. I put my things out on the chair last night. I like the feeling of preparation. It means I haven't got to worry this morning about what to wear. Anyway, it's not as if there's a lot of options. Over the next 2 months, I'm cycling with a couple of changes of clothes and some extra layers for the freezing cold days. Like today. Promises to get up to an almost balmy 9 or 10 degrees Celsius. So I'm wearing padded longs, knee-length shorts with lots of pockets, a merino undershirt, green lycra vest, 2 pairs of socks. Yeah, warm, thin, knee-length socks, and over the top, a pair of clashing-coloured ankle socks in case I get cold. I've got my neck buff, cycle jumper, and the high-vis Map of Europe top, last worn on my TV show Wackaday in 1990. I found it in my collection of tops that are labelled, "Wow! I wonder when I'll ever wear that again." I love it. It looks great. And with a map on my chest, there's a chance, just a chance, I might not get lost.
A clip of Timmy Mallett reading from his book, Utterly Brilliant, My Life's Journey. And Timmy joins me now. Now, it's a good job you're joining us on the Christmas episode, because you're a big fan of Christmas, aren't you?
I love it. I absolutely love it, Robert. And it's just a joyous time of year.
It is fantastic. And a big part of it is, of course, gift giving. Now, books and audiobooks aside, which are the best presents, what do you think about gift giving this year, especially with the cost of living crisis looming?
Now, this is an interesting thing because people have been talking so much recently about the cost of living squeeze. And how do we make Christmas gift giving special without it costing a fortune? And this is important, really, because we, you know, on the day you want to open a gift because it's nice to get given something and it's nice to give something. But the receiving part of it can be fraught because do we want unwanted gifts? No, we don't want unwanted gifts. We tend to take them down to the charity shop and recycle them as fast as they can go. There's been a survey done, said about 20% of us don't want anything. I think we do. I think we do want gifts, but we want gifts that we can use time and time again, that you'll come back to a year or so later and go, that was a good present. And something happened this year that has got me thinking about this and mulling it over, because I set off earlier this year, Robert, on a balmy idea to see if I could do a circumnavigation of Britain on my bike, painting images along the way, inspired by artists such as Turner and Constable, who 200 years ago couldn't go traveling around Britain because around Europe, because there was a dictator. Napoleon has a lot to answer for. So they went off instead around Britain. And Turner, for instance, painted lots of the castles in Wales. And I found myself thinking, I wonder if any of those places are still there and if you can find where he stood. And for that, I needed a map. So I got onto my friends at Ordnance Survey, who've been map making for 200 years. And they gave me a map like this of the whole coastline of Britain, so that each day I could work out exactly where I wanted to go and which bits I might want to see. And if there was a detour I might want to do, because, oh, there's an old railway line I can cycle along there, or there's a castle or some feature that I wouldn't want to miss. And then see if it's possible to paint it along the way. So I'll give you an example. Here you go, Robert. Where's that?
Oh, wow. This is radio, so I'll just tell the listeners that Timmy's holding up a picture of a castle on a hill. Is that in Scotland?
It's a good guess. It's actually one of the Welsh castles.
Ah.
This is the Welsh castle at Harlech on a stormy day. And I've cycled into Harlech on the west coast, you know, singing at the top of my voice, Men of Harlech, and thinking, where did Turner stand to paint his picture? And it turned out to be a rocky outcrop. That's where I stood, on the same rocky ledge. You can find the exact rock that he stood on 200 years ago and go, well, that's his view. And the difference is you can work out, was he here or, you know, 10 meters away. It makes that amount of difference. And you can stand in the same place. And I'm finding myself thinking, this is wonderful. The coastline is so iconic. And particularly around, you know, your neck of the woods, Robert. Where are you from again? Remind me.
I'm in Ayrshire.
Well, you know, God's own country. You come across Galloway through the wind. Wow, what a windy coast. You know, Caerlavallock Castle near Dumfries. And then you come down to Dunluce and you go up to Bar Hill over the wonderful Ayrshire Alps. The colours were just stunning. I was there in Maytime with bluebells out across the woods. And you know that song, Bluebells of Scotland, Robert?
Hmm.
I didn't believe that there were bluebells out on the moorlands in such a way that there are in Scotland, because further south in England, they're in beech woods or on chalk escarpments, not in Scotland. In Scotland, the whole hillsides, the Ayrshire Hills, you come into that beautiful town, down to, you know, the electric braes at Dunure.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I know the electric braid very well.
Absolutely stunning. I stopped actually at Dunure. Let me see if I've got a picture of it. I've got a watercolour I did of Dunure Castle, and I put it somewhere nice and safe. So you'll have to trust me on that.
See, all I remember about that is the castle's beautiful, but I was there as a kid, so the playground in front of the castle.
That's the bit that you remember.
That's the bit I remember. Now, I didn't know you were so oh, that's for the listeners. Timmy's holding up another painting of...
that's Dunure there, where they shot the Game of Thrones. And then in the distance, there's that lovely outcrop, which they call Paddy's Milestone.
Ailsacraig, yes.
Exactly. I mean, it's just a joyous part of the country. Now, because I stopped at these places and painted them, I can remember every bit of our 5,000 miles of world-class coastline around Britain. And the maps have been absolutely key to this. You can get now this wonderful thing on your phone. You can have an app, a map on an app. And that way you can travel the whole length and breadth of the country on your phone with an app. And the great outdoors is free to give. It's free to go and explore. It's good for your mental health. Maps are, for me, the present to give this Christmas. And the custom maps are really brilliant. They're utterly brilliant because you can have a photo of who you're giving it to or whatever on the front. You can choose that. You can choose where you would like the map to center on. So if we have a favorite beach or a favorite place that means something to us, there's a map that you will treasure forever, and you'll pore over it, you know, while you're waiting for the king's speech on Christmas afternoon. You'll get the map out and start thinking, oh, I wonder, perhaps we go off and have a little adventure and then explore across the Isle of Arran. You know, let's go to Locranza. It'd be brilliant over there.
I've also got on a Christchurch College, Oxford tie, gifted to me by the porters in the lodge when I met the Bishop of Oxford for a good luck you're gonna need it blessing last month. The blessing was in the stunning surroundings of Christchurch Quad, and it worked as far as the city boundary. When I reached Oxford United's football ground, I got a puncture. United's press officer, Chris Williams, was delighted, and he laughed. It's always exciting when you plan something, Timmy. That Christchurch tie is going to get heavier and heavier as I pin badges to it all along the way. I've made a typically nutty Timmy-type decision to wear that tie every day. Cyclists don't wear ties, and I haven't worn one since the last funeral I went to. Oh, hang on. That was 2 days ago, over 500 miles away, in Aberdeen. My older brother Martin, who with Down syndrome and language and learning difficulties, had lived 64 filled years. And he died last week. Ma Bubba Martin has always been the inspiration for my Camino to reach my potential, as he did, with all the challenges he faced every day.
I didn't know you were into cycling, didn't know you were into art, until I had a listen to Utterly Brilliant, My Life's Journey. What brought you to write that book?
A sense of adventure and a sense of curiosity. I think curiosity is a curious thing. It leads us to ask questions and to be inspired by places to go and see. My life's journey is built around the pilgrimage route, the Camino de Santiago, which is an ancient pilgrimage route, been around for 1,000 years. And it's all roads lead to Santiago de Compostela in northwest Spain, where the bones of the Saint James, the brother or cousin of Christ, are supposedly buried in the cathedral there. And in the Middle Ages, 250,000 people a year would make their journey to Santiago and home again. Well, I set off in springtime, and I got the beast from the east, and I cycled from home across Europe. And it coincided with something rather special to me and my family, because my dear brother Martin inspired me to live in the moment, to be in the here and now. With Down syndrome and language and learning difficulties, Martin would always talk about today is the best day ever. Every day was the best day ever for Martin. And sadly, he passed away a week before I set off on my journey. So I carried with me his name tags and placed them at special places along the way. So a castle, a church, a wayside marker, a great view. And I marked the journey with those name tags. And I wrote about it in My Life's Journey and linked it into memoirs of my career in radio, TV and itsy bitsy. And that enjoyment of art and history and people you meet along the way and the things that you see. You know, life's a great journey and it's important to experience it and to make the most of each and every day. Today's a great day. It's been snow. It's cold and frosty. The colours are intense, Robert, because we've got that low winter sun. And it makes me want to get the watercolours out and paint it and get my maps out and go off and explore.
So it was Martin's outlook in life that anyone can reach their potential that really helped you on your way.
Yeah, Martin's, it wasn't a preaching thing. It was just an enjoyment of this moment, this day. And we don't tend to do that very much, Rob. We tend to say life will be great when I get the new promotion or the new job or when I go at the weekend somewhere. You know, we're always looking ahead. Well, Martin's aspect way of living was to say today, it's right here, right now. And it took me a little while to realize that. And that's what I carried with me when I did my cycling adventure and wrote about it in Utterly Brilliant, My Life's Journey, which contains paintings I did along the way. And it's available as an audio book, also in hardback and paperback. It's something I'm really proud of. And the things that it taught me about enjoying this moment, even in the weather of the Beast from the East. Well, thank God we have weather, Robert. Thank God we have it. And thank heavens to my brother for teaching me this.
Now, it feels even more important. I can't let him down. I'm carrying my brother's memory and his courage, and I'm determined to live each day with his example in my heart. Martin always wore a tie. He was the best-dressed mallet in all our family. I've decided to follow his example and dress for the occasion. The occasion is to cycle alone, from home, across three European countries to Santiago de Compostela in northwest Spain, and back again, painting the adventure as I go. You know, I've always made a mallet statement through the things I've worn. Colour has always been key in my fashion sense. One Thursday night, I saw Trevor Horn of the Buggles on Top of the Pops singing "Video Killed the Radio Star." He was wearing bright red glasses and I was immediately struck by them. I've worn specs since the age of seven. And when I saw Trevor's on TV, I went straight into town and had my very own pair made. The optician understood what I wanted from the photo I showed him, and his lab created them, the first in my great collection of fabulous glasses.
Timmy Mallett, Utterly Brilliant, My Life's Journey is available in print and in audio as read by Timmy himself, commercially now. And Timmy Mallett will be back at the end of the show with the books of his life, and Red Sail will be chatting to Noddy Holder about Merry Christmas, everybody, after this.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, "Alexa, call RNIB Helpline" for more information. RNIB. See differently.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting RNIB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to RNIB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
It's as much a part of Christmas as Santa, mince pies and a tree. Slade's evergreen hit, "Merry Christmas Everybody," first topped the charts in December 1973 and has sold more than a million copies in the UK alone. But what's the story behind the song? The band's frontman, Noddy Holder, has written his autobiography, titled Who's Crazy Now? He joined me in the studio for a special Christmas interview. So here it is, Merry Christmas, everybody's happy. Well, Noddy, you've written two books.
I have.
Your autobiography, Who's Crazy Now?
Yeah.
And The World According to Noddy.
Yeah.
Life Lessons Learned in and Out of Rock
yes,
and Roll.
Yes, correct.
Which did you enjoy writing most?
Well, I enjoyed both of them because I came at both of them from a different angle. I was commissioned on both of them. I didn't present them to the publishers at all. Both books were commissioned. The autobiography was commissioned way back in the turn of the millennium, or as my long-past mum used to call it, the linoleum. And they said, it's about time you did an autobiography. And I was probably, I'd have been 54 years old at that point. So it probably was time for an autobiography because I'd had rather a colourful life. But the second one, which was The World According to Noddy, it was a series the Constable, the publishers, were doing. And the first one they'd done was The World According to Joan Collins. Uh-huh. And I think for the next year, they wanted somebody at the other end of the spectrum as far removed from Joan Collins as possible. So they picked on me.
Well, I don't know. You've been a male model, a bit of a sex symbol.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad I came. Yes, you're right. I did win Rear of the Year once, and I did win Best Tie Wearer once. You know, I've had my fashion moments, even though people would dispute that.
Well, Slade were pretty natty dresses.
You're right there, and I still am, I believe. And, I mean, I've got my flat cap on today, very colourful flat cap and scarf matching. Yes, I still like to nattily dress, whatever state I'm in. I find it, actually, if I'm in the supermarket or wandering around and people recognise me, they get disappointed if I'm not wearing a bit of colour. They actually get disappointed if I'm not wearing my top hat with mirrors, but I don't, and platform boots. But I don't wear that anymore, but they do get disappointed. So I like to dress a little bit colourful, and then people sort of don't get too disappointed if I'm not all tarted up, as in the glam rock era.
As somebody who grew up in the 1970s, which were a pretty drab time, and glam rock provided all the colour and the excitement and the experimentation.
But it certainly did, and I think that's what happens in times of misery. It happened in the 20s when the recession was on then. Showbiz became very colourful. And there again in the glam rock era, the country was going to pot, basically, much as it is today. You know, you had the three-day week. There were strikes everywhere. The miners were striking. The grave diggers were striking. The bakers were striking. Power cuts were going off 10 o'clock at night. So there was no TV or light. And I think bands like us provided a bit of fantasy land, showbiz, a bit of colourful existence to people's lives, because the country was in a mess. And I think that's why us particularly, Slade particularly, became so big at the time, because our records were pretty much colourful, rowdy records, cheerful records, and it put people in a good mood.
Incredibly easy to sing along to.
Correct.
And fun as well. I always got the impression that you were really enjoying yourself.
We did. We had a great time in those days. I mean, we were young lads, four young lads from the Black Country, the middle of England, working class. You know, we never had any money or anything like that. You know, we'd spent like 10 years working in bands before we had a hit record, various bands. When we did get that taste of success, we made the most of it. Who'd have ever thought, you know, four guys from our hometown would be flying first class around the world, staying in first class hotels, visiting Tokyo, Sydney, New York, San Francisco, all these colourful towns that we'd only seen on the movies. It was great for us, and it was fantastic.
But something that really comes out of the book, whilst it was great fun, it was also very hard graft, wasn't it?
Well, we were a road band. We were a touring band. So not only did we tour constantly, we also had to fit in the recording and the writing of the songs, of course, in between the touring. So it was certainly from about 1970 through to about 76, 77,
We never actually had a break. It was constant on a roller coaster, really. It was hard.
Were you surprised by the success?
We were. We always knew from the first day we formed, we always knew we'd got something from our first rehearsal. We sort of clicked. We knew we'd got something different. Of course, when you go into the music business, you never think you're going to make a living out of it at first. And it was a long struggle with the lineup as became successful. It was 5 years before we had a hit record. We were slumming it around the clubs and pubs and everywhere trying to earn a living just to feed ourselves. And then we met Chas Chandler, who was the guy. He was in the Animals, the band The Animals, and he discovered, produced, managed Jimi Hendrix. So we got the benefit of his experience in and out of bands, and we spent another 2 years with him before we had a breakthrough on the charts. It was a surprise when you finally make the chart. It is a surprise, but you don't know what's hit you then. But certainly for a band like us, because when we appeared on Top of the Pops, which in those days had probably 18 to 20 million viewers a week, you got a big audience seeing you. And whether you liked us or not, you were talking about us because we made an impact on that show. And we basically became the house band on that show. It was a whirlwind. Once we got the first hit, then the next hit record we had was a number one for 4 or 5 weeks. And then the next one, it just took off so big. And it was so fast. And the record company were demanding at least 3 singles a year, at least 1 album a year, sometimes 2. Just getting the hit is the first step on the ladder.
We've got to talk about the big Christmas hit. Now, I hear there's a story behind that song, that actually it was a challenge that was issued by Jim Lee's mother-in-law.
It was. It was Jim's mother-in-law who said to him one day, why can't you write a song that would be coming out every year? Not necessarily a Christmas song, but a birthday song, an Easter song, a summer song, whatever. He sort of took that as a challenge from his mother-in-law. I think he thought she was saying that we weren't good enough to come up with something like that. And he remembered a song that I'd written, actually the first song I'd written, way back in 1967. And it was in the hippie days. And it was a sort of hippy-dippy ditty. And it was called Buy Me a Rocking Chair to Watch the World Go By. And it was very psychedelic era type thing. And I played it to the band. The band said rubbish. So it went in the bin. But six years later, Jim remembered this song that I'd written, particularly the chorus, the hook. And he put a new verse to it. He remembered the chorus. He got this verse melody. He played it me and it sort of fitted together. Then I went away and wrote a Christmas lyric to it. All in one night, actually. I went to the pub and had a few drinks. I was staying at my mum and dad's house in Walsall in the West Midlands that night from the pub, and I sat up all night and I did the lyrics in one fell swoop during the night with a few shots of whiskey in between. And it sort of clicked. It sort of clicked into place very quickly. Went back to Jim's a couple of days later, played him what I'd got lyrically and that, and it all clicked. And we played it to Chas Chandler, our manager and producer. We played it to him and he said, well, the record company have been crying out, because by that time, we'd already had a lot of hits and 5 number ones by that time. It was 73. We'd had Come On Feel the Noise was a number one that year. We'd had Squeeze Me, Please Me a number one that year. And the record company had been crying out for us to bring out a single at Christmas, which we'd never done before. Not necessarily a Christmas song, just a single at Christmas. And Chas heard it and he said, well, the record company will be freaked out if you've come up with this. We didn't tell the record company that we'd got a Christmas song, but we scheduled a Christmas release. At the end of the tour, European tour we'd done in July, we ended it at Earl's Court in London, which was the first big rock gig that had ever been performed there. 5 days later, Don Pell had a horrendous car crash. Mm. His girlfriend was killed. And he was hospitalised for 6 weeks. The doctors didn't give him 24 hours to live. So it was a very downer period for us. And we'd got this Christmas song sitting there. Didn't know whether Don was going to survive. He was that ill and knocked about that we decided to take him to New York to get him back behind the drum kit because he had no memory, he had no taste or smell, his body was wrecked. We took him to America to coax him back behind the drums because the doctor said that's the only way he'll ever play again. So we took him into a studio in New York at the end of August, the most un-Christmassy type of atmosphere you could ever have had. He couldn't remember the 4 minutes from start to finish. He couldn't play it on the drums because his memory was shot. So we had to piece it together in little bits, which we'd never recorded like that before. So it's all it's like a jigsaw puzzle, that record, how it's put together. And we thought, this is not going to work. It's not going to work, this. It's just too disjointed and whatever. And then it was mixed. We went off on tour to sort of get Don playing again, and we went off on tour in America. Chaz mixed it in the studio in New York, and he brought it back to the record company in Britain. We'd not really heard it. We'd sort of heard a rough mix of it. But he brought it back to the record company in UK, and they flipped. And this was probably in September time. They flipped and they said, this is just a great record. This is going to be, because we were top of the tree for sales in Europe at that time. They said, this is going to be such a monster record. We came back and it was all in place. The record company had scheduled the release date. They'd scheduled appearances on Top of the Pops. They'd scheduled appearances in Europe on TV shows. The release date was the first week in December. We had 500,000 advance orders, which in those days was a silver record. You got a gold for $1 million in those days. You get a gold for much less these days. But in those days, we got a silver record pre-orders before it came out. And on the first day of reorder on the Monday, because we'd premiered it on Top of the Pops, it went straight to number one the first day of release. And the first day of reorder, it did 360,000 records in one day, the first reorder. And they had to go to Europe, to the pressing plants in Europe, to press the singles up because they couldn't cope, and the factories in UK alone were having records shipped in from America, Europe, everywhere to keep up the demand. And we'd done $1 million. By the time Christmas Day came, we'd done $1 million on the single. It was the fastest selling single up to that point in the UK. It took a life of its own. It got a life of its own. Once the initial furore was over about it in 1973, it's never been deleted. It's always been released every year. You know, nothing to do with us, just the record company keeps it afloat every year. And it's still going as strong now as it ever was. We never thought for a minute a song like that would be going 46 years later. We never imagined it would be.
Do you ever get tired of hearing it?
I don't, actually, no. It's one of those things that I get... I'd probably get a different glow from it to what the public gets from it because I'm so used to it. And I sort of relate it more to the time of the band, to the accident that Don had, how he took to record it, the trauma we were going through as a band at the time, whether we're going to survive with the same lineup as the band. I relate to it more in that way than probably the success it had in 1973. You know, it's weird when you're actually performing on a record, you relate to it in a different way. And it was a traumatic time for the band. As I say, we were top of the tree in Europe and Australia. We'd had so many record sales and so much success and massive tours, and it could all crumble in one day because of this accident. You know, it was a weird time for us, weird.
I was interviewing Charlie Greamer, the drummer from Wizard.
Oh, I know Charlie, yeah.
Yeah.
He's a good old brummy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, you pit them to the post in 1973 for the number one.
Yeah, yeah.
And
which Woody still reminds me of. I still see Woody regularly. He still reminds me.
And, of course, there was the custard pie incident.
Yes, okay.
How do you remember that?
Well, we were on there doing the Christmas Day Top of the Pops. The Christmas Day Top of the Pops is always the number ones from the year. Ours was the current number one, the last number one of that year, 73. So we were finishing the show. We'd already played two songs on the show because we'd had two other number ones that year. So had Woody. He'd had See My Baby Joy that year. So we were all there, and we knew Wizard, and we knew all the guys in Wizard, particularly Woody. I mean, we'd all grown up in Birmingham playing the same clubs and seeing one another's bands, so we knew one another really well. It came to the end of the harmony bit at the end of our Christmas record, finishing off Top of the Pops. And, of course, Woody and all the wizard mob, they all come with custard pies. They'd had them all ready. So as I'm finishing off the vocals, they all splattered me with custard pies, yeah. And that's how the show ended that year, yeah.
Happy days.
But that's the fun you had in those days. You see, probably it's got very cool now. The whole scene's very cool. You don't see many bands smiling when they're on telly or nothing. With us, it was all, especially with us and Wizard, you know, you had a laugh when you were on TV. You had a good time. We weren't trying to be cool. I don't think we could have been cool. If we had a tried, we couldn't have been cool. We weren't that sort of band. When you come from the Midlands, especially, there is a certain humour there in the Black Country and the Birmingham. You don't want to get things mixed up with the Black Country and Birmingham. It's two different things. People class it all together.
I have been warned.
But we do share a particularly dark sense of humour. We find fun and laughs in things you shouldn't find fun and laughs in, especially in those days. And when you've been on the road and we're knocking around as long as we'd been, and certainly as long as Roy would have been and the lads in his band, we'd all been through the mill. We weren't like overnight successes. We'd all paid our dues. We'd all worked the German clubs. We'd all been on the road for years. Of course, Woody had been in two successful bands already. He'd formed The Move, so he'd had a big string of success with The Move, with a lot of hit records. He formed with ELO with Jeff Lynne, so he'd had a few hits with them. Then he left that band and then formed Wizard. So we'd all been through the mill.
And you clearly love performing and you've gone on to a successful acting career. I remember you in The Grimleys. Playing yourself as a violin teacher.
Yeah.
And you still do quite a lot of voiceover work, don't you?
I do a lot of voiceover work, yeah. It's still... I worked in radio for over 20 years. I had shows on different stations in radio, which is still a form of performing. Mm. Different way of performing, but still a way of performing. How that came about, really, was in America, on our last tour of America, I was going into a studio to do an interview in LA, in Los Angeles. They were surprised at my knowledge of the music industry. They said, do you want to come in one night while you're still in LA and present a show? And I thought, yeah, great, I'll go in. And I got to the studio and the news broke while I was there that Marvin Gaye had been shot. And I was a big fan of black soul music. So obviously, being LA, they had to do a tribute show to him immediately, which I hosted off the cuff, and they loved it. It gave me a thrill of radio. So when I come back to UK, I'd had offers of presenting before, and so I started to do bits of presenting, and it just grew and grew to weekly shows, etc., which I did do for quite a long time.
And The World According to Noddy actually grew out of that, didn't it?
It did. The publishers heard me and they heard my outlook on life, what I thought about education, what I thought about politics, what I thought about fashion, what I thought about everyday life, really. And that's why they picked me. I mean, I don't do social media now. Everybody keeps telling me, you should be tweeting, you should be doing this. I don't do any of that. People using my name do it, which they shouldn't be. But pretty much I was doing that on radio years ago, you know, spouting what I thought. And that's how the book did come about.
And seeing as you are a voiceover artist, is there any chance that you might record audiobook versions of your two books?
I've never been asked. Maybe I wouldn't mind doing it, but they've never really asked me to do it. So maybe in the future, yeah, I would quite enjoy it, I think.
Clearly got a great story to tell on both sides, and well, maybe we can get you back in to do it.
Well, the books were very different. I went at the autobiography, which I co-wrote with a lady called Lisa Vareko, who used to be the music critic of The Times. I chose her. They gave me a list of six people to write with. I knew some of them, but I didn't know her. And I picked her because she knew nothing about Slade. She was much younger than me. And I thought she'd come at it from a very fresh point of view. She didn't grow up with us or anything. And so basically, I wrote totally on my own my young days before Slade. And I sort of did interviews with her and she pieced together the Slade part of the book. It needed somebody to I edit it instead of me just waffling on and sort of put it from a fresh point of view, really. And that's why I chose her to sort of ghostwrite the slide part of the book. I think it worked. Because I'd done it into a tape machine, she'd got the feel of how I speak and my sense of humour, etc. And she did the rough draft, and then I came to it and then chopped and changed stuff to make it sound like it was from my point of view and not somebody interviewing me and doing it, you know. So I wouldn't say that, or I wouldn't say it like that, and that's how I worked it.
Are you a keen reader yourself?
I used to be on the road, but not so much now. I still buy books. Some of them, they sit on shelves for ages. My wife's a big reader, and she's an author herself. She writes plays and books, so she reads constantly. So there's always been books in the house. My kids all read, so we are a big reading family. But I used to read all the time on the road. I used to get through tons of books on the road. I'm more of a TV addict now. I watch tons of TV, and there's so much TV to catch up on, because I do like watching, particularly dramas and stuff like that, and documentaries. And so I spend more time watching TV than I do reading books, which is wrong. I mean, I should have kept up reading books more so than I have done. But I always loved reading. I loved reading when I was at school. I did O-level, what it was called in those days, GCSEs. I did that in English literature and English language. And I read some of the real heavyweight classics in those days, because we did have to do it for the syllabus in those days. So I did read a lot of stuff when I was a kid. I mean, I always remember the first books I ever read as a very little kid. I mean, my mum used to brag that I was reading books at two. I don't believe it for a minute, but, you know, mums say about their kids. But she always said that. But I do remember, you know, at the age of four and five, reading Treasure Island, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, these sort of books, Dickens books, even at that age. I might not have understood every word it said, but I certainly understood the stories at that age. And I've always had a love of storytelling, which probably overlapped into the singing, the songwriting, of course. And having a book, having books out, I mean, it was a great ambition for me. I never thought I'd do it, like I never thought I'd be a successful rock star. But, you know, these things come your way in life, you know, they cross your path in life, and you jump on them when you get the chance.
Well, yeah, and to have two books by Noddy Holder sitting in the British Library for the rest of time, it's quite an achievement, isn't it?
I like it. I like the thought of it, yeah, absolutely. It certainly stands alongside my achievements as a musician as well. I'd certainly put it on a par with it, the same as I would with stuff I've acted in. As you say, I was in the Grimleys for several series over a five-year period. When I first did it, they had me in on the pilot just to do a cameo appearance, singing a song. And then the writer, Jed Mercurio, who is now the biggest writer on TV, he wrote The Grimleys. He was a Midlands lad. He said to me, do you fancy doing the series? Not just a cameo, but a part in the first season. I said, yeah, great, you know. And he gave me quite a bit to do in the first series. I was not an experienced actor by any stretch, but I learnt as I went along. And then the next series gave me bigger part and more to do. And when it came, as the series went on and on and on and on, I became a much, much bigger part. I was the headmaster of the school in the last series. And that also stands besides, you know, the other things I've done. I was in Coronation Street, the live 40th episode of Coronation Street. That was a lifetime ambition for me. I mean, I absolutely adored Coronation Street. I'd watched it right from the day one. And I was at, it was actually the time I was doing the Grimleys, one of the series of the Grimleys, and I was at an awards ceremony, and I was sitting on the table next to the Coronation Street mob, who I knew most of them from Granada television. So I knew a lot of the cast and the producers and whatever, and they're sitting on the next table, and they're taking the mickey. We'd all had a few drinks. It was late at night. They were taking the mickey. They knew the 40th live ep was coming up. And they're all saying to the producer, oh, you should give Noddy a part. He's an actor now. He's doing the Gribblies. Give him a part, give him a part. It was all drunken talk late at night. That was a Saturday night. And then the Monday morning, my manager got a call from the producer saying, will Noddy do a cameo in Coronation Street? As a character, not as myself. I mean, it was terrifying, really. Live ep, and it was Coronation Street. And I saved the cobbles. My character came in to save the cobbles on the street because they were going to be dug up and tarmacked over. The road was going to be tarmacked over. So my character saved the cobbles. But that was a great thrill for me. And it was nerve-wracking, very nerve-wracking. But it was a great thrill to be on a show like Coronation Street. And then following off to that, I did the movie version of Bob the Builder.
Yep.
I was a character in Bob the Builder. With Elton John and Chris Evans was the other guest stars, but I had quite a big part in Bob the Builder. It was the first movie they did, and I've done stuff with Peter Kay on, you know, in his Max and Paddy series. So I've done bits and dabs over the years. I still get offered quite a lot of acting roles. The reason I don't do more now, mostly what I get offered, frazzled rock and roll stars on the edge of suicide, drunken, drugged, addled rock and roll stars. So usually I'll give them a miss.
Thanks so much to Red Seal and to Noddy Holder. And now on Read On, it's back to Timmy Mallett for the books of his life. Now, Timmy, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
A book from childhood that I like reading?
Yes.
Well, I like the Narnia stories. I was very impressed with them. They were always rather fun. And the other things we liked were the Dragon in Danger books, those childhood stories.
Your van's got stuck, said Susan, by way of opening the conversation. One of the men looked gloomily at her and said nothing. Will someone come and pull you out? Went on Susan.
Yes, said the second one. Them peskies and furries, what we hear so much about in Cornwall, we're just waiting for 'em.
The first man stopped looking gloomy and smiled at Sue.
Do you live in these parts, love? He asked.
No, she answered. I'm having a holiday.
And what's your name?
Susan, what's yours?
Fred, he answered, and my mate, he's called William.
Sue was rather stuck for what to ask next. She couldn't go on past the van, leaving the dragon behind. Nor could she go back, as the lane was far too narrow for the dragon to turn round in. After a great effort of thought, she said, Will you be staying here all night?
Till next Christmas, I shouldn't wonder, said William, who had a long, sad face like a dismal horse.
Suddenly, a brilliant idea came to Susan, an idea which would solve all difficulties. I've got a friend here who could help you, she said rather breathlessly.
Oh, yes, queried William in disbelieving tones.
He could help you, I'm sure, persisted Susan. Shall I ask him?
Go on, said Fred. Be a sport, William. A kid wants to play.
I'm not feeling like playing, retorted William.
Well, I got kids of my own, said the cheerful Fred. I'll play. Where is he?
He turned to Susan with a good-natured smile. Just here, in the lane, answered Sue. You won't be frightened of him, will you? You see, he's a dragon.
That's Carol Marsh reading from Dragon in Danger by Rosemary Manning. Available in audio from RNIB Talking Books, as are all of the Narnia books. And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
Yes, I do. I have picked up not long ago, actually, the Little House on the Prairie books and reread them about it. There's a lot of social history in that, in the way that people treated Native Americans, for instance, and that's quite interesting, because although they were showing fairness in their timescale, in today's way of looking at things, we would say that's out of order. But it was right at the time. It just reminds me, the only way you can live is in here and now.
Once upon a time, 60 years ago, a little girl lived in the big woods of Wisconsin in a little gray house made of logs. The great dark trees of the big woods stood all around the house, and beyond them were other trees, and beyond them were more trees. As far as a man could go to the north in a day, or a week, or a whole month, there was nothing but woods. There were no roads. There were no people. There were only trees and the wild animals who had their homes among them. Wolves lived in the big woods, and bears, and huge wild cats. Muskrats and mink and otter lived by the streams. Foxes had dens in the hills, and deer roamed everywhere. To the east of the little log house, and to the west, there were miles upon miles of trees, and only a few little log houses scattered far apart in the edge of the big woods. So far as the little girl could see, there was only the one little house where she lived with her father and mother, her sister Mary, and baby sister Carrie. A wagon track ran before the house, turning and twisting out of sight in the woods where the wild animals lived, but the little girl did not know where it went, nor what might be at the end of it. The little girl was named Laura, and she called her father Pa and her mother Ma. In those days, and in that place, children did not say father and mother, nor mama and papa, as they do now. At night, when Laura lay awake in the trundle bed, she listened and could not hear anything at all but the sound of the trees whispering together. Sometimes, far away in the night, a wolf howled. Then he came nearer and howled again. It was a scary sound. Laura knew that wolves would eat little girls, but she was safe inside the solid log walls. Her father's gun hung over the door, and good old Jack, the brindle bulldog, lay on guard before it. Her father would say, "Go to sleep, Laura. Jack won't let the wolves in." So Laura snuggled under the covers of the trundle bed, close beside Mary, and went to sleep. One night, her father picked her up out of bed and carried her to the window so that she might see the wolves. There were two of them sitting in front of the house. They looked like shaggy dogs. They pointed their noses at the big, bright moon and howled. Jack paced up and down before the door, growling. The hair stood up along his back, and he showed his sharp, fierce teeth to the wolves. They howled, but they could not get in.
That's Regina Regan reading from Little House in the Big Woods, the first book in the Little House on the Prairie series by Laura Wilder, one of many books in the series available from RNIB. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Actually, yes, a book called The Greatest Night. It's a history book about William Marshall, who was a top knight in the Middle Ages in the reign of Richard the Lionheart. Yeah, I know. I'm reading history. It's lovely.
William Marshall was born in England around 1147, at a time of unrest. The kingdom was in the grip of a ruinous 15-year-long conflict, as King Stephen struggled to resist his cousin Empress Matilda's attempts to seize power. Both possessed strong claims to the realm, so the country was divided in its allegiance and spiralling towards anarchy. One medieval chronicler described this as a period of great strife and disorder, in which England was plagued by war and the law of the land was disregarded. Great swathes of the landscape were left scarred and ravaged, such that one could go a whole day's journey and yet find only empty villages and untilled land. Amid such desolation, the wretched people died of starvation. One contemporary admitted that in these years, many said openly that Christ and his saints were asleep. Yet for all the chaos and horror of this era, there were those who prospered during the Civil War. With the collapse of crown authority, local warlords were left in many regions to impose some semblance of order, and this power was often abused by the predatory and the unscrupulous. One such was William's father, John Marshall, a nobleman of middling rank with a lordship centred in England's West Country. By birth, John was not English or Anglo-Saxon, but a French-speaking Norman. Back in the 10th century, his Viking ancestors, known then as the Northmen, had settled in a region of northern France that came to be known as Normandy, literally the land of the Northmen. They embraced some of the customs of their new homeland and even adopted French or Frankish names, but remained warlike and land-hungry. In 1066, their leader, William, Duke of Normandy, William the Conqueror, led an invasion force across the English Channel and scored a stunning victory at the Battle of Hastings. This Norman triumph left England's last, short-lived Anglo-Saxon king, Harold Godwinson, and the cream of his ruling nobility, dead on the field. In its wake, William assumed the crown of England, while retaining control of Normandy. An Anglo-Norman realm was forged. And it was in this cross-channel world that William Marshall would be raised.
Jonathan Oliver, reading from The Greatest Knight, The Remarkable Life of William Marshall, The Power Behind Five English Thrones, by Thomas Asbridge. Available from RNIB Talking Books. And Timmy Mallett, thank you so much. And that's it for the Christmas edition of Read On, the audiobook show. If you want to talk about anything you've heard on today's show, I can be found on Twitter at @talking_books. Read On, the audiobook show is available on Spotify, on Google, on Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast app. And there are over 300 shows there for you to browse through. Read On will be back in the new year, but remember to have a very Merry Christmas.